You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 19th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. It is 1500 in Moscow, 1400 in Chisinau, midday here in London and 9 a.m. in Sao Paulo. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme, after Russia's sham election over the weekend, we look at what's next for the country's opposition with the exiled activist Vladimir Milov. After that,
Russia has been posing threats to our democracy, and that's why we believe that our democracy will be safer within the EU.
Moldova launches a referendum campaign to join the European Union, while Romania starts building NATO's largest military base in Europe. We'll look at Eastern Europe's rising influence in countering Russia. We'll also look at why Japan has finally raised interest rates after a whopping 17 years, and we'll explore the legacy of Belgian designer Dries Van Nouten. And finally, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, you are back from Brazil and you've brought a pretty unique collection of stories back with you.
Very unique indeed, from plastic surgery obsessions to Bolsonaro's very own perfume.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. We start today's show with Russia, where the death of opposition leader Alexei Navalny, along with Sunday's election, has cemented Vladimir Putin's position as the country's leader for the foreseeable future. The question now becomes, what next for those who still dare to oppose him, both inside and outside of Russia? Well, I'm joined now by Vladimir Milov, a Russian opposition politician, economist and energy expert who formerly served as economic advisor to the late opposition activist Alexei Navalny. Vladimir, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I did want to start with Navalny himself. How did his death impact you?
Well, hello, many thanks for having me. Of course, his death is having a devastating impact because it's a very rare occurrence in Russian totalitarian politics that a popular democratic leader emerges who continues to very much influence the situation after being poisoned, jailed, and now even after he is dead. So we didn't have many leaders like that who really ignited millions of people for fight for freedom and democracy in Russia. So that's a devastating loss, obviously. But I think Navalny's main legacy is that he managed to create a nationwide movement which will endure, which will survive his death. And as a matter of fact, we have been continuing working for the past 3.5 years since he was poisoned and was no longer capable of participating in our daily activities. We only had some limited communication with him. So I think also it's pretty visible also from the outside world that there are really very many people in Russia who still believe and have faith in Russia's democratic future. They attended Navalny's funeral on Sunday. They had attended the opposition protest called Noon Against Putin. So there is a significant movement that was ignited by Navalny, and that will go on. And this is our best hope at the moment.
Tell us more about this sort of nationwide movement and how you see it at the moment. I mean, the fact that there were those who came out to protest, as you say, on Sunday. At this point, they are, especially if you are protesting in Russia, you really are essentially taking your life into your own hands, aren't you?
That's true. It's an enormous risk. And we now have, according to a Memorial NGO, which has a very conservative system of estimating the status of political prisoners, there are almost 700 political prisoners in Russia right now. That's about 3 times bigger than what we had in the past couple of decades in the Soviet Union under Brezhnev, Andropov, or Gorbachev. So the environment is pretty harsh, but I also have really very big feedback from people across Russia. And they are beginning to say that they're tired of being afraid. After all these 2 years of full-scale war against Ukraine and enormous repression, They say that they cannot afford themselves to just sit and do nothing. They want to go out and protest. And we saw that. I mean, the first months of 2024 had actually brought a lot of very interesting new developments, huge queues in support of presidential candidate Boris Nadezhdin, who campaigned on the platform of ending the war but was not allowed into the race. We saw huge turnout at Navalny's funeral and now significant turnout at the opposition rally on Sunday during the voting day. So you see, something is brewing here. People are, you know, letting go of being afraid and coming out in big numbers. I have a sense that this protest movement will be growing and we will be finding other formats which will be a bit more secure personally for the people, but would still allow them to protest.
You mentioned the war in Ukraine there, and I did want to ask you about that generally. But first, I was curious what you have made of the sort of cross-border attacks from Ukraine into Russian territory that were also happening in the run-up to Russia's election on Sunday. Is that a real threat in some way to Vladimir Putin?
This is not a real threat like it might topple his regime, but this is very painful and attacks on Russian territory become routine. But listen, this is what we have been saying all along, even before Putin's full-scale invasion. Like, I myself really did not believe until the last moment that he would invade, because one of the reasons was that this way he was exposing Russian territory towards military attack for the first time since 1944. And as a matter of fact, this is what we are seeing right now. This actually demonstrates the whole insanity of Putin's decision to invade Ukraine. So that was fairly predictable. And we have been, through our broadcasting onto the Russian audience, explaining all the time that Russia does have vulnerabilities and people of Russia will indeed suffer because of Putin's aggression against Ukraine. Ukraine has a right to defend itself. So this is not an unpredictable development at all. And our message to the Russian people is consistent. We should end the war and pull out all of the Russian troops out of internationally recognized Ukrainian territory. That's the only way to end this whole thing. However, I would say along with other major factors like major difficulties within the economy and deteriorating living standards and harsh repressive environment, international isolation, these are the issues that will further spark negative public sentiment against Putin brick by brick. And these attacks on Russian territory will also have their own impact.
Well, how much does Vladimir Putin then essentially need success in Ukraine when you describe that sort of brick by brick? I mean, do you feel like Russians could eventually turn on Vladimir Putin if he loses the war or loses too many lives or at too much of an economic cost somewhere down the line?
Russian society in its majority is already sending a strong message to Putin that the war should end. That was visible in the past few months in opinion polling and even at Putin's press conference in December when he took questions from Russians. And even the Kremlin host said that they received a flurry of questions about the war, with the main one being when this whole thing would end. So there is a pretty strong anti-war sentiment in the Russian society. It's only been contained by repression. But question is for how long, because you see that these grapes of wrath are beginning to be surfacing already. It is not that Putin is under like immediate pressure, but concerns are mounting that public opinion might be a constraining factor. Along with sanctions, economy, losses on the battlefield, this might add significant pressure so that Putin at some point in time will reconsider. In terms of, you know, the war and public opinion, nothing short of establishing control of Kyiv and major part of Ukrainian territory will be able to be sold as success. Some advances in Donetsk region and Zaporizhia region, the Russian public just doesn't buy it. There is this mounting question, what was this whole thing for? To incorporate some districts of Kherson and Zaporizhia into Russian territory? Was it really worth it? So, as a matter of fact, Putin does not have a realistic battlefield gain. than that he can use as a good sell to the Russian public. So anti-war sentiment will continue to multiply on this background.
Now, Vladimir, you served under Putin as well yourself, I understand. And I did want to ask you from that, how has he changed, if at all, frankly, if the signs were kind of there even back then when you were serving under him? And how have the people around him changed?
He already had very distinctive authoritarian instincts when he came. And that was the unpleasant moment when I was an official in government. I voted against him at the first presidential election in March 2000. I voted for Grigory Yavlinsky, and many other colleagues did so as well, because he was clearly, I mean, he was aiming at centralizing, concentrating power in his own hands and dismantling various democratic checks and balances and institutions. That was pretty visible. What changed is that, you know, there's this phrasing that goes saying absolute power corrupts absolutely. He's the wealthiest man in the world now. He's protected by nuclear weapons. So it's, imagine like an organized crime group, a mafia boss, being in a position like that. He also has the best healthcare in the world available to him. So he thinks that he would rule for another 20, 25 years or so. So he's unrestrained. And that totally corrupted him. He was already a man clearly prone to corruption when he arrived. But removal of checks and balances, becoming insanely rich, insanely powerful, that had, completely twisted his persona and I think removed any human elements that were remaining, if any were ever there.
And just finally, Vladimir, you yourself are living in exile and were sentenced to 8 years in prison in absentia. I just wonder how precarious you find your own position at the moment.
Oh, I have a police car patrolling 24 hours near my home now because my colleague, Leonid Volkov, chief of staff of Navalny organization, was attacked here in Vilnius with a hammer exactly a week ago. So we do take some precautionary measure. There can never be 100% guaranteed security, but the big question is whether we would continue doing what we're doing. And yes, we would. It's very simple as that, because we actually take pride in the fact that Putin is out to get us here. It means that we're really doing something very painful to him. We're broadcasting onto the very big audiences in Russia. We still maintain the protest movement that is alive, despite all Putin's efforts to crack it. We give useful and worthy advice to Western governments on how to enhance efficiency of sanctions and instigate further cracks in Putin's system. So yes, what we're doing is very painful to him, which is why he's out to get us, which is why we have to be cautious, but we will not give up. We will continue doing what we're doing.
Vladimir, thank you very much for joining us. That was the Russian opposition politician Vladimir Milov. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. The 2008 financial crisis, if you can remember back that far, prompted a collapse in stocks and home prices and led central banks around the world to drop interest rates to record low levels. And while most countries eventually started raising rates again as their economies recovered from the shock and inflation became the bigger worry, Japan is one country that never actually did. Until today, that is, when the Bank of Japan finally abandoned its policy of negative rates and said it would raise rates from -0.1% to zero. It is the first policy hike in 17 years, and joining me now from Tokyo to tell us more is Tomohiko Taniguchi, a foreign policy specialist, former correspondent for Nikkei Business, and former special advisor to the late Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Tomohiko, let's start with the symbolism of this move, the historic nature of it. We are only talking about 0.1 percentage points, and yet this is a really big deal for Japan, isn't it?
Well, it is a big deal because very few people in the younger generation have experienced anything like this. Not only since 2007, but even before. The Japanese financial speculative bubble collapsed in 1990, early 1990s. Since that time, the Bank of Japan, the central bank, has maintained zero bound, not quite zero, but zero bound interest rate. The interest rate is the price of money. And in other words, not many people in Japan have been accustomed to the fact that money comes with a substantial cost. So in terms of symbolism, this is a huge leap.
It is quite incredible the way you describe that, that it's like an entire generation is not used to interest rates being rising. I mean, what prompted this then, do you understand? Is it that Japan's economy is kind of doing well enough in order to take an interest rate rise, or is it that inflation is becoming a bit of a worry?
Both are the case. The Japanese business is growing, finally, and the shortage of human capacity, manpower, has become very much prominent, which has ignited a number of companies, which has caused salaries and wages rise, never seen again over the last 20, 30 years. And it indicates that cost push inflation is creeping and price hike has been occurring since the invasion, Russian invasion of Ukraine, and commodity prices since then have gone up also in Japan. So multiple reasons have worked, but it's not a negative sign, but a positive indication that the Japanese economy is doing fairly well.
Now, one of the interesting things always about central bank policy is that they can be as much about kind of steering the mood almost of a nation, right, as it is about the numbers. I mean, 0.1 percentage points isn't much on the face of it, but it can have a very large effect if people start buying differently as a result. We're all reporting on this now. I mean, what impact do you think this will have on consumers in Japan?
Interestingly, the rise of interest rate theoretically must work negatively towards the share prices and stock market, but the Japanese stock market has responded by raising its indicator, Nikkei stock index, and yen has further weakened. And I think it's going to give a positive net impact on consumers' sentiment. And certainly market participants have long assumed that this would be the case.
So if it has had this almost opposite reaction and leads to stocks rising and sort of, cheeriness in the economy, does that mean we could see more interest rate hikes in the future to kind of tamper that again? Or is this the end of it for now?
Conventional wisdom seems to hold that this is not the end of the interest rate hike, but not frequently, not as frequently as you have seen in the case of the U.S. Federal Reserve. Most of the predictions focus that Japan is going to raise the interest rate again this year, but not twice.
And just finally, Tomohiko, I mean, the fact that this took so long, 17 years, I wonder what that says about Japan's economy for you. I mean, it was in an extremely long period of stagnation, essentially. Is this kind of signal, does it give the Japanese the sense that they are finally coming out of that?
The late Prime Minister Shinzo Abe long expected that this sort of scenario could materialize, but he did not see that happening simply because the Japanese corporate business leaders remained so much cautious. At one point in time in the recent past, 60% of the GDP have been found dormant in the form of cash and deposits in the aggregate balance sheet of the corporate Japan, indicating that Japanese businesses were extremely cautious and risk averse, and that changing, I think, it's a positive thing.
Tomohiko Taniguchi, thank you very much for joining us. Now here's Monica Lillis with today's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. America's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said that Israel killed Marwan Issa, Hamas's deputy military commander. Mr. Issa is thought to be third in command in the militant group. Hong Kong's Legislative Council has unanimously passed a new national security law. The new legislation, which will come into effect on Saturday, grants the government more authority to quash dissent in the city. US President Joe Biden plans to visit Nevada and Arizona this week to promote his economic policies and bolster support in the two battleground states. The American leader will begin his trip today in Reno, after which he will travel to Las Vegas and Phoenix. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Monica. Now, one of the more inauspicious aspects of Russia's election on Sunday was the fact that polling stations were also opened in occupied territories, including parts of eastern Ukraine and also in Transnistria. It's a region of Moldova that is very likely to be the next front if Russia chooses to invade another nation. Moldova, also like Ukraine, is in turn seeking to edge closer to the West, and its president, Maia Sandu, has now launched a referendum campaign to join the European Union. Paula Arizano is a Moldovan-Romanian journalist and author. She joins me right here in studio. Good afternoon, Paula.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Let's start with what happened in Transnistria on Sunday. How many people actually voted?
Well, the press in Tiraspol, which is the Transnistria capital, said it was something like 46,000 people who voted. But actually, they voted in six polling stations. And so if you did the maths, that means that every person voted in like 7 seconds or something like that, which is kind of
like
impossible. So the number is actually very low. Even the official number is lower, the lowest in 18 years, which shows that Transnistrians are not really that keen on Russia anymore since the full-scale invasion.
And can you describe for us what the situation is like in Transnistria at the moment? How much of a Russian presence is there, or how much of a sort of pro-Russian separatist movement is there currently?
Sure. So Transnistria is normally dubbed as the original kind of frozen conflict. Russia invaded... Russia supported separatists fighting against Moldovan forces in 1992, just when I was born. And we had this kind of brief, bloody conflict there, which ended in a peace deal that Russia coined so that it can keep its influence on Moldova and have this kind of breakaway region, which has its own so-called government and currency and so on. The local population does not have many kind of economic opportunities or even career opportunities. So students there still study from Soviet-era textbooks. They can only go to universities in Transnistria or in Russia. So their futures are kind of predetermined, although they can also make some courses, conversion courses, in order to continue their education in Moldova or elsewhere. And some of my friends, for instance, who are photojournalists or journalists who've come from Transnistria and are now based in Moldova or Ukraine, say that when they arrived to Moldova, they expected that everyone was their enemies and wanted to kill them because that's what they had been told at school. And they realized that actually that was all propaganda. So there is a lot of propaganda that is being aired in Transnistria, in schools, in the media. Militarily, there are 1,500 Russian troops there. Most of the soldiers, though, are locals who are just earning a salary that way. And there are also 20,000 tons of Soviet-era ammunition, which has not been very well maintained and is probably not easy to use in an armed conflict, but it could generate explosions, I guess, and it does raise some concerns. Russia, of course, has signed an international treaty in Istanbul in 1999 saying it would withdraw its forces from Transnistria and also the ammunition, but it hasn't done so. Surprise, surprise. And since 2022, something that's new in Transnistria is that its trade with Ukraine and the kind of black market that it has relied on for decades is not possible anymore. So now 70% of its exports and imports are with the European Union. And that means that Moldova has imposed stricter rules and regulations, including making businesses from Transnistria pay duties. That is not something that the oligarchs in Transnistria like. And so they are launching all sorts of operations and self-victimizing to international actors, as they have done in their All Deputies Congress on the 28th of February.
That does also bring us to this European Union referendum, as you're mentioning trade with the European Union there. I mean, how strong is support for EU accession in Moldova generally at this point?
The majority of the population supports EU integration because they see that as a chance for peace and prosperity. But of course, the Russian propaganda and influence is very strong. We have had the Russian media air on like the main channels, TV channels, for 3 decades. This has only been kind of reduced since 2022. And there are political actors who get their funding and their support from Moscow, who hope that they can get back into parliament in next year's general elections. So it's still a fight. We're still fighting for the kind of vision of the future of Moldova. We have upcoming presidential elections in October, where it's quite likely that incumbent Maia Sandu, who's pro-European, will be re-elected. And on the same day, we are going to have a EU referendum. And this is actually, so according to the government, what they want, the pro-European government, what they want is to have the kind of EU integration written down in the constitution so that all political actors are engaged in this European future for Moldova, whereas the kind of pro-Russian forces are seeing this referendum as an opportunity to compromise Moldova's EU integration and put a stop to it and go back to this kind of grey area of Russian influence.
Well, Paula, before we let you go, I did want to also ask you one question about Romania, because it has begun construction of what will become NATO's largest military base in Europe. I wonder if you could tell us sort of why Romania has been chosen, what this means for Romania's role in NATO.
So actually, from the information I read, it seems like this base will not be bigger than the Ramstein base in Germany, but it will be one of the biggest in Europe. It's a project from 2018, which was voted in 2020, but it has been delayed because of the pandemic. It's part of a series of kind of measures that Romania is taking in order to consolidate the kind of NATO eastern flank, but also in order to discourage attacks from neighbors like Russia. It's clear that there is a war in the Black Sea, and this base, which is not actually new, is just an extension of an existing base in Constanza, is basically very near to Crimea and to Odessa and all of these ports that are now being used in the Russia-Ukraine war. The base should be understood, from what I understand from experts, as a national effort for Romania to consolidate and modernize its military infrastructure, so that in the case of an emergency, NATO allies can trust and use this infrastructure in Romania. From my conversations with experts, they're saying this is coming a bit late. It was delayed by the pandemic, and it was caused by the 2014 first invasion of Ukraine. But it's better to have it later than never. The construction is going to take about 20 years from what I saw.
Better later than never. Paula Arizano, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. To the world of fashion now, which just this morning received the news that an icon of the industry, Dries Van Noten, is stepping down from the very label that he founded and that helped to put Belgium and Antwerp in particular on the fashion map. Monocle's fashion director, Natalie Theodosi, joins me here in studio to tell us more. Natalie, tell us first of all just about his label, about the person, what sets it apart?
So Dries Van Noten, I think, is one of the great designers of our generation. He started 38 years ago in having studied at the Royal Academy in Antwerp, and he was part of what is known within the fashion world as the Antwerp Six. It was a group of designers that graduated at the same time. There was also Ande Millemister, Walter van Beerendonck. And like you said, Chris, they really put Belgium on the map for fashion and really stood out because each of them had their own distinct aesthetic. They didn't participate in the industry's trends, and they really focused on fashion for its craft, the artisanal side. They make their own fabrics. There was always the spirit of experimentation that you didn't get in the bigger capitals where commerce is more of a focus. So, and Dries Van Noten, except from that romantic artisanal side to his label, also really succeeded over the last 38 years to create a very fine balance between staying true to the artistic side of fashion, but also building a very successful business, which was sold to the Spanish group Puig a few years ago to secure the company and his employees. So a great man, and it's a loss for the fashion industry, but I think it shows that it can be positive to leave on a high and to know when it is time to step down.
Leave at the height of your game. I mean, tell us more about the man. You have interviewed him before, I understand, as well. What's he like?
He is one of the few designers in fashion, I'd say, who doesn't let ego get on his way. He's very humble, very, very personable. He'll make you feel very comfortable when he's speaking to you, even if he has gotten very, very famous within the fashion industry over the years. And I was very lucky to go to his studio in Antwerp and interview him. He's also one of those people who doesn't speak to the press, doesn't seek the spotlight very much. He doesn't host events. So it was a really special occasion. And he was incredible to speak to because he's so knowledgeable. He has an incredible archive of all the handmade prints and patterns that he creates. He talks about craft, the embroiderers in India that he always partners with. And he has a wealth of knowledge, not just about fashion, but architecture and design. He hosted a group of friends at Axel Verwoerd's, the architect's private residence, for dinner when I visited. And you could also really see that he has an incredible community of artists and designers who really collect and treasure his work.
Well, then, given all of that, I mean, when a designer of such prestige leaves the scene, I mean, how much does that impact the industry? How much does it impact a brand that is established? But like, what will happen with this brand going forward?
In a letter that he sent to the industry, he said that in June he will showcase his last menswear collection. And then in September, his studio team, which has worked with him so closely over the years, will take over and produce a women's wear collection. But they are also now working to find his successor. So he'll be involved in that, which is quite interesting, that he'll have a say in who gets to take over. And I think there will be a lot of rumors and speculation in the coming months. But I'm confident that since he is involved, they'll make the right choice. And I think that that was part of his goal, to leave room for a new generation of designers to come in and have an opportunity that he had over the years.
A new generation, but his legacy secured. Natalie, thank you very much. That was Monocle's fashion director, Natalie Theodosi. You're listening to Monocle Radio. And finally on today's show, Monocle's senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco joins me here in the studio for a flick through the Brazilian newspapers. Faye, you have some fun stories for us, but do I also understand that there's a bit of breaking news that we need to talk about before we get to the fun? It involves Jair Bolsonaro.
Absolutely. Well, let's start the order of stories because the world moves fast, Chris. So let's start with Jair Bolsonaro. Yes, indeed. So basically, just a few minutes ago in the Brazilian press, it's now in all the news agencies, the federal police just indicted Bolsonaro for a suspected fraud in his vaccination card. Of course, this will be a moving story. You know, there's been a lot of controversy because he was anti-vaccine, but I think he actually had a shot. You know, there's this whole controversy in Brazil. And of course, he can't be a candidate because he's being accused of so many other things. But that's the breaking news from Brazil. And funnily enough, I was going to talk about Bolsonaro, but not about that.
You were not going to talk about Bolsonaro for that reason, but that is certainly a story we'll continue following here on Monocle Radio. But let's perhaps then, given that, though, turn first to the story you were going to talk about with Jair Bolsonaro, because in addition to his various trials and court campaigns, in the meantime, he's launching his own perfume this week.
Yes, the Jair Bolsonaro Eau de Parfum, which I have here in front of me. Well, unfortunately, I don't have the bottle. It's a shame, Chris, because I was there in Brazil. I just came back Monday morning, but it will be released later this week. But I have to say, it's sold out. and the creator of the fragrance is Agustin Fernandez. He's a very flamboyant Uruguayan makeup artist. He's a close friend of Michele Bolsonaro, Bolsonaro's wife. And I was reading the description of the scent, an explosion of fresh citrus with woody elements, and you get involved in an aura of mystery and elegance. Apparently, that doesn't really...
Does that apply to Bolsonaro himself? Elegance and mystery?
Definitely not. He's not mysterious. He's not elegant. But it sold out. It's a success. It cost 197 reais, which is about 35 euros. A little bit too expensive for Bolsonaro, in my opinion.
There is something about populists trying to perhaps fund trials with perfume, shoes, and other things. But we'll leave that there, I think, for the moment.
Yeah, there is a market.
There is clearly a market in many countries for this kind of thing. Let's move on to one other story, a couple of other stories you have for us. There is this comment from L'Occitane's owner saying Brazilians do too much plastic surgery. This sounds like it's making tremendous waves in Brazil.
Absolutely. There was a big story on the financial pages of Folha de São Paulo. He is an Austrian billionaire, Chris. Look, so many connections here. Reinhold Geiger. But the thing is, he said, Brazilians do too much plastic surgery. They start when they're 30. When they're 40, they have to do another one. They're destroying their faces. That's a very strong comment. But the thing is, Reinhold, he loves Brazil. So this interview was done in Trancoso, which is a small seaside town in the state of Bahia. Beautiful place. And so he even created a special brand for L'Occitane in Brazil. It's called L'Occitane au Brésil. So he does have this connection. He loves the country. He loves the people. He invests a lot in culture as well. But he's got strong opinions. Maybe the market, I'm surprised about this. Brazil only corresponds to 2.5% of all the L'Occitane share around the world. It's very little
is
for
it about to decline, perhaps a little from that?
Perhaps a little. I mean, but I have to say, I think Reno needs to be a bit smarter here. We do a lot of plastic surgery, undeniably so, but we have a strong beauty market. I mean, not everyone likes their Botox or fillers, whatever. Sometimes, you know, a good cream, maybe he needs a better marketing thing. I don't know.
It Do you imagine at all that when you say he has some credibility, but nevertheless it is somebody from Austria criticizing Brazil, how are Brazilians going to take to this? Is there going to be any kind of consideration of plastic surgery as a result?
Well, to be fair with him, I mean, it is true. When I go to Brazil, I think plastic surgery, it's widely spoken by everyone. And you do see people with slightly funny faces in the streets because there's all sorts of different doctors. We have very good doctors, but it's very widespread. And you don't necessarily need to be upper middle class or rich. I think even if you have perhaps not such a wealthy situation, you would still pay for plastic surgery instead of buying a car.
Well, let's move on to one final story, Fernanda, before we let you go. Brazilian pet shop owners are in a major competition with each other, it sounds like.
They are. And besides plastic surgery, we love dogs and pet shops as well.
Dogs, pet shops and plastic surgery. I'll remember that.
Just so you know, in Brazil, we have 285,000 establishments of like pet shops. It's a lot. I mean, I think we're one of the biggest. I think we're the second biggest market in the world, just behind the US. But remember, Brazil's a smaller population and poorer as well. So it's quite interesting. So the way that they try to compete in the market is choosing the right name. And they love a dog pun. And there's a whole article. I have to give credit to this amazing journalist, Matheus Piconelli. He wrote a whole piece, Why Brazilians Love This So Much, How You Have to Avoid Clichés. And there's so many examples. But
and they're drawn in by the pun. Is that the idea?
Yeah, but you have to avoid clichés like buticão, which is boutique, you know, the word boutique. Buticão is like kind of a cone is like dog in Portuguese. That's common.
That's like too easy.
That's too passé. You know, we don't want that anymore. But this
you found
is
a good one while you were there.
I took this picture. I loved it so much. It's called Elizabeth, which is a play with Elizabeth II, the former queen here in the UK.
It says Elizabeth II, so it is like your second pet? Is this like for second pets, first pets, whatever you like?
But I have a funny story. I was in a cab when I took this picture, and the driver, he was really mad. I think he was a royalist. He was like, this is so disrespectful. How could they do this to the queen? And I was like, chill, you know, we're in Brazil, it's fine. But yeah, the cab driver didn't like it. Probably he's not a customer.
I do wonder what they will come up with for Charles, perhaps. Now they have to get into their Charles puns. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Emma Searle. Our researcher was George Ruskin. And our studio managers were Lily Austin and Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.